Hi, I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands. Today, we have Austin Channing Brown on the show. She's a thought leader, speaker, and New York Times best-selling author of the book I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness.
You know, Aim, it was my 15-year-old daughter, Ella, who saw Austin speak at her school and immediately texted me and said, you have to have her on the show. It was really cute when I invited Austin to the show. She said, I'll come on as long as I can meet Ella. So it was really sweet.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm so glad she invited her. And I cannot wait for our audience to hear this thought-provoking conversation. But Sam, before we get started with our question, let's have Ella ask the first one.
Okay, so it's such a big topic, so there might not be, but if there's one big thing that you could tell parents, I guess, regardless of race, but also whose kids maybe aren't in communities that are super diverse, like one message that they could bring to their kids, what would that be?
Yeah, it's that you have to be the one to talk to your kids about race, right? I think there are a lot of parents who opt out. And funny enough, for either reason, they opt out because there's all kinds of diversity, right? And then if you're like, well, we don't need to talk about it because our city, our suburb, our neighborhood, our whatever is overflowing with diversity. It's all around us, right? And then on the opposite end, parents think, well, since there's no diversity, there's no reason to talk about it. You know, there was someone with a podcast and a parent called in and said, when should I start talking to my kid about race? And the podcaster said, somewhere around the time that they're 6 months old. And the parent was like, I'm sorry, what? What do you mean 6 months? And she said, not for your kid, for you. Because you need to start practicing right now. And you need to get comfortable with the conversation. And you need to start reading. And you need to start preparing. So that by the time your kid is asking questions, you already have answers and you already know how you want to approach it. So I wish I could tell parents that it is part of your responsibility in preparing for what I hope we all want, which is an anti-racist world, right? That you have a role in that.
So Austin, you have a 3-year-old son, right?
I do.
Do you talk to him about race?
You know what? Right now, we try really hard to let him enjoy being a little Black boy. So the ways that we don't talk to him about race outright, but we do what I think a lot of Black parents do, which is when we put lotion on him, we talk about how beautiful his skin is, and we're intentional about telling him how smart he is. We play a lot of Black music in our house. We just moved, and so I am very intentional about the art that we put up, the fabric choices that we make, everything. But I know that the day is coming when we won't be able to, well, we'll have to talk the other side. You know, we won't just be able to talk about the beauty of what it means to be Black, but we will have to also talk about the ugly side of America. But we have not done so yet because we just want him to maintain his little innocence and his little joy for as long as makes sense, you know.
What will that conversation look like?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think part of it will depend on his school and his teachers and his principal and his curriculum, you know. I suspect that to some degree, these conversations will unfold naturally because of my job. Like I mentioned, I just bought a new house. And so we just picked up these new chairs. And as you all can see, there's like a million books in the chairs. And they're all about racial justice.
So where do you live now? Where did you move?
We're outside Detroit.
How different is the community you've moved to from the community you grew up in?
Yeah, that's a great question. well, this neighborhood is really nice. Really nice. And where I grew up to isn't in like shambles or anything. I remember being in college and talking with my roommate about what we would do after we graduated and what our, you know, goals were and everything. And we were both very socially minded even then. And we both agreed that as long as we could make $30,000, afford Cheez-Its and a chocolate shake at least once a week, that was it. That was all we needed. To now be living in a house that my dad walks through and he's like, okay, let me make sure I don't break anything because I sure can't replace nothing in here. It feels miraculous. But as we were choosing a neighborhood, in some ways, thankfully, we were looking during the election season. And so we were able to see how many signs were in the yards and what those signs said. We were very intentional about what the demographics would look like in the neighborhood, in the schools. We were adamant that my son not be the only one in his classroom ever. That's just not an experience that we want for him. And we chose a daycare in which there are other little Black boys just like him. He's in a community that at least most of the time feels safe. And unfortunately, we have to wait to see if the neighborhood proves me right.
Can you talk a little bit about what the experience of being the only is like, both at work and in school?
It's not fun. It feels like the weight of your entire community is sitting on your shoulders. It is the double consciousness that W.E.B. Du Bois talks about, where I am aware that I am a human and an individual, right? My name is Austin Channing Brown, and I am responsible for me and my actions only, right? But I am also aware that teachers, if I do something, say something, that is now going to be a reflection on every Black kid in the school, perhaps every Black kid that they meet, right? That when the topic of Black history comes up, that I am carrying the weight of making sure that my community is now well represented and that I speak for it. And honestly, it's isolating because I think white people do not realize how often a lecture, a curriculum, references, icebreakers are built around the idea of their own normality and therefore universality. And so often when you're the only one, you just want to scream, that's not my life. That's not how things work for me. It's exhausting. But most white people have never experienced that level of exhaustion.
I believe that. I want to ask another question about school. You wrote in your book this chapter around the stories we tell and talking about how, you know, we erase many of the ugly parts of American history. Like we don't really talk about slavery even in school or the reality of slavery, right? We say this existed, but we're not going to talk about how it existed.
That's right.
Did you know that when you were growing up? Like, were you cognizant of that when you were taking American history when you were a teenager?
Yes. I remember my mother having a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Yes.
And I don't remember anything in that book, y'all. Any details in that book. But I remember her having it. And I remember she wanted so badly to round out my education, right? Mm-hmm. To say, okay, glad you're learning about Christopher Columbus, but let's think about this word discovery.
Wow.
How do you discover something where people already live? You know, and let's talk about what happened when he arrived, okay? So I feel like a lot of Black household education looks like that.
And now for a quick break.
So in terms of the system and the American school system, how close is that to being dismantled in terms of what we learn, the curriculum, and changing it? Because the more I read about it, the more infuriated I am. And when I hear what my kids are learning in school, I feel angry. So
yes.
How do we erase that? How do we go backwards?
Well, it's really important that white parents say exactly what you just said, right? Because the dominant feeling is that Black folks are the only ones who are upset. And that because we're the only ones upset, we must just be in our feelings and it must not be that important. But for parents, for white parents to say, there are not enough Black female teachers, in this school. I don't like this curriculum. We are not teaching the whole history of America. For white parents to say, my child is also suffering by not having a more diverse, inclusive curriculum and being taught by the diversity that exists in the world, my child is losing out too.
Is there any organization that everyone can get behind that's like close to changing this? Who's at the forefront of this movement?
I honestly don't know, because there are so many battles being fought, right? There is the battle around curriculum. There is the battle around hiring and retention. There's the battle around specific problematic teachers and or professors. There's, right, that it isn't just one thing. And so if this is something you're passionate about, my encouragement would be to find out if there's something local happening where you are. You know, are there parents who have already been speaking to the principal about this? Is there sort of a multicultural subsection of the PTA or of the, right? What is happening? Where is the conversation happening where you are? Is the question that I would start with. Because it's entirely possible that people have already started working on this and you just didn't know. You're just not on the newsletter.
So your parents, you've already talked to us about, they named you Austin. And in your book, you write that they did that to outwit everyone by giving their daughter a white man's name.
Let me tell
you. What are your parents like?
How well it works. The mail I get. My parents are characters. My mother is an intellectual butterfly. Mm-hmm. She is extraordinarily smart and questions everything and loves debate and conversation. But she also has a real estate license. She has like ceramic making classes. My father is a very big personality. He is one of those personalities who knows everybody and everybody knows him. He had a very similar upbringing to the one I had. So my dad is from an all Black community. But by the time he was 16, because of a basketball scholarship, he was able to go away to school. Like, he went to boarding school. But he didn't really want to be there, so I'm not sure able is the word he would use. He talks all the time about how he called home and was like, I'm going to be around all these white folks. Like, get me out of here. What is happening? Take me home. And so, yeah, so he went to boarding school where he was the only Black kid in most of his classes. And then he went to a private white college where, once again, he was kind of the only one in a lot of his courses. But I don't think there's any doubt that both of those things have made him who he is. So on the one hand, he is like really hood and really down with the cause. And on the other hand, he is like, but what do I need to do to maneuver around these white people so I can do what I need to do? And I think those things have both come out in the way he raised me.
How has your experience with race as a child impacted your adult life?
I really thought, because I was educated around white folks, that I was the white culture whisperer. I thought that I could not even so much code switch, though maybe, but I thought I knew what they wanted to hear. I knew who I was expected to be. And I was pretty good at walking the line between who I actually was without losing too much of myself when I had to be involved with white folks. And to some degree, I was advantaged even in that I attended the same elementary school from the time I was in preschool all the way until the eighth grade. So I think there's one teacher who was at my school longer than me. So wow. I very much felt like I owned the place.
Yeah, no, that is actually great for building confidence. That's awesome.
Exactly. Sometimes I would walk around the hallways with no hall pass because I knew I could. If anybody stopped me, they would just be like, oh, hey, Austin. Yeah. So even though I was at a predominantly white school, I can't say that I felt like an outsider. I very much felt like, no, this is my school. I would not change my educational experiences. I would not change where I went to high school, which, again, was a private white Catholic high school, but had 20% diversity and was located in the hood. And so again, it's just felt like my school, that did not prepare me for adulthood when my health benefits were attached to whether or not I could make white people like me. In my education, the only thing that happened was maybe I got a bad grade. And I was shocked. I didn't think whiteness had the power to, that whiteness would be so powerful that I might lose myself.
Do you remember that first moment when you experienced like, oh, whoa, this is a new world for me?
I remember my very first job out of college. And I was promised, I had been a business major in college, and I was promised by the CEO of the organization, who was a woman, a white woman, that she would teach me and train me on fundraising and how to ask for money and how to write grants. And right. So even though my position was probably, you know, an administrative assistant, something someone right out of college would have, she was like, but don't you worry, because we are going to like rock this. Right. And before I knew it, friends, I was putting rolls of toilet paper in the bathrooms if the janitor didn't show up. And the like board of directors was almost entirely white. And it was my job to go like get them food when they had their big meetings. And so I would run around the city collecting everybody's orders and then drop it off. And when I tell you how weird it is to be a young Black woman dropping food off for a bunch of old white people, it is not. Oh, you all don't see this? Does nobody see this? And I had started to try to speak up really by thanking the people around me who didn't make me feel weird. And then I got in trouble for that and was told that I was trying to stir up conflict. And I was just like, wow, none of my tools are working here. And it was jolting.
And now for a quick break. So what was your career trajectory after that? I mean, how did you get to this place where you are now this, you know, award-winning writer chosen as Hello Sunshine's Book of the Month?
And can I just add to that too, which like, sorry, Sam, to jump in. Like, why did you start writing like your blog? Like, how did all of that play into it?
Oh God, it's all divine intervention, friends. So Trayvon Martin is murdered at the hands of George Zimmerman. A couple years later, I want to say two, but don't quote me on that. 2 years later, the actual trial of George Zimmerman is happening, and I'm working at this church. The church has two services, a Saturday night service and a Sunday morning service. And it just so happens that one of my friends from college is going to be the one who is preaching during this weekend that the George Zimmerman verdict comes down. So she comes on Saturday night. She does her thing. She talks about whatever it is that she talks about that Sunday. Saturday. We all go home. We get the news that George Zimmerman is not going to face justice for what he did to Trayvon Martin. We come back the next morning, and my friend, who's going to be preaching that morning, supposed to do the exact same sermon she did the night before, she says, so how are we changing the service today? Are we doing an all-Black panel on how folks feel? Are we turning this into like a prayer service? Like, what are we doing? How do we need to do this differently? And she is explicitly told that she should not mention one word of what happened. Not Trayvon, not George Zimmerman, not the verdict. She is to say nothing. And then the pastor, after telling her, you do not say anything, says, I hope that since this is my church, that you will respect the like authority that I am casting over you right now, and then bows his head to pray over the service. So she can't even respond.
So what happened next?
She got up and she gave mostly the same sermon with the exception
of also mentioning what happened.
Of course. She didn't, right? She said before she got on stage, she did tell one of the other like staff people on the show, if you let me on that stage, I am going to say something. So if there's something you need to do right now to make sure that I never make it on that stage, by all means. Mm-hmm. But there's no way. She said, there are people here who have come who expect me to say something. And I can't not say something. She said, no, I'm not going to be disrespectful. I'm not going, I'm not going to start yelling and screaming. I'm not going to, right? Like, it will be embedded in the sermon. There's a lot of head shaking happening right now, friends.
but why? Like, but why?
Fear. Fear of pissing off major donors to the church. Mm. Fear that people would get up and walk out. I mean, I don't know. Whatever the hell white people are afraid of when a conversation about race happens. And it was weeks later that I was called into my supervisor's office for a meeting that was supposed to be about helping me, supporting me in my workload. And instead, I was asked to give my 2-week notice so that the week that I would be gone forever, my whole staff would be on a retreat. And when they would come back, I would simply be gone.
And you would have quit. You were not fired, right? Because that would have been more convenient for them.
You got it.
Yeah. It's not a shocking story. It's probably a story that happens every single day in every single city across America.
And that is why I had to write a book about it, right? Because here I am aware. And obviously this is multi-layered, right? So I tell that story, but it's also that Black women in certain positions, maybe in every position, but in different ways, are expected to be just like all the white people until they need us to be whatever their version of Blackness is, right? So in a church context, I have a girlfriend who was in like the music department, and she was constantly expected to sing white Christian contemporary music, right, to the best of her ability and to make all the white people feel all their feelings until MLK Day. And then on MLK Day, she needed to like belt out the gospel and do the spoken word and like show up in all her Black female glory. Right. And that microcosm is happening across America, right? That Black women are expected to be just like white women until you need someone who's sassy, or until you need someone who's angry, or until you need some inspiration, or until you, and then I'm supposed to be the genie where you rub my sides and I come out and give you all this Black culture and then I put it back so that we can all go back to normal. And that's why I had to write a book. I had to write a book so that Black women knew they weren't making this up. That these experiences were real and they were happening, and the expectations around whiteness, if they go uninterrogated, can rip apart our souls. And I wanted to try to be a part of putting a Band-Aid on the souls of Black women.
Do you feel you accomplished that?
Most days. Most days. I've had to really adjust how I approach this work. So, for example, this is so embarrassing, but when I first started doing this work, subconsciously, I would try really hard to make white women cry if I was like doing a lecture or a workshop or something on racial justice. And that's just the whole truth, friends. It's the whole truth. Because I thought if I could get white men to cry, then that must mean they care, right? That must mean they finally see me as like a whole person. And now they're going to go out and do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe that's not what happened. And more importantly, it was exhausting for me. I mean, it was always exhausting for the people of color in the room, right? For that to be like our secret mission is to make all the white people in the room get it. And so now when I have a lecture, when I give a workshop, when I do anything publicly, I am consciously thinking that my standard of success is whether or not Black women feel seen and affirmed and heard. So that if I was to do it all over again, Black women would say, I'll be there. If instead a Black woman would be like, child, that wore me out, then I have failed. So I'm learning. I'm learning how to do this differently so that Black women are the definition of whether or not this was successful at all. That their emotional well-being is of the utmost importance.
what led to that transformation and goal?
Yeah. I was in a training, a like white privilege, get your stuff together, white people, right, kind of training. And the trainer was using the exact same like format that I would be using. So she was doing like the same activities and right, same thing. And at the end of the activities, she had physically turned her body so that she could only see the white people in the room. And there were a handful of people of color who were now standing behind her, but who had their hand raised because they wanted to contribute to the conversation that was happening. But she was so focused on making sure that the white people in the room got it, she literally couldn't see the hands of the people of color behind her. And I thought, never again, never again. Because it wasn't until I saw someone else doing what I do, right, that I realized, oh, I am treating this conversation as if white people are the linchpin to racial justice. So much so that the people of color in the room are being ignored. We can't see them. We can't hear them. They're raising their hands and we don't notice. They have something to contribute and we don't get to hear it. And I decided right then I would never do it the same way.
Our conversation with Austin was far-reaching and we covered a lot of ground. So Sam and I felt that it deserved two parts.
So tune in next week when we dig into Austin's supportive marriage, the racist origins of the modern day prison system, and our shared obsession with Oprah.
Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would so appreciate if you would leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer and editor, Laurel Moglen, our podcast associate, Phoebe Cranefuss, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.